with what is showing up as it's showing up. And that can be an art that demands almost all of our intelligence and subtlety and courage. One thing that's nice about the Dharma is that we can kind of let down our hair a little bit with one another here. That we all can admit that we are the way we are, and there's a lot that we have in common. We're all vulnerable to mental states. We're all vulnerable to diseases. You know, some of the courage that we may have can be in admitting that it's not always so easy to be a human being. And in the normal world, there's often a need to have a facade around that, like, oh, you know, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. You know, like, and you get through the day better if you don't involve people in a long embroiled story of how you really are a lot of the time. And in the ordinary world, there's not the time, and it can be a kind of offering to people to say, like, that you're okay when they ask you. But with some people, they really do want to know. And I think in this practice, there's the sense of really wanting to know where our hearts are. So the suffering, we can admit it here. It's all kind of like empty your pockets and throw it out. We'll see, like, you know, it's like a police raid. Put it on the floor. And if you don't know on some level that there's stress or that you have issues or that, you know, maybe your knowledge of life is incomplete, you wouldn't be here. So we're all here together. And there's something kind of sweet and there's something kind of fortifying about that. At the same time, another thing that's nice about being here is that we can sort of show our jewelry also, the things that we really care about and value. In the group this afternoon, a few people shared about their moments of release in life when the cantaloupe in Lissa's mouth turned into the whole universe and things like that. And stuff that if you do tell certain people, they'll just say you're crazy or that something, you know, happened to you that was kind of weird and just get back to normal, get back on track and start, you know, do the dishes or behave in the way that functions sort of on the ordinary level. Well, you know, ordinary life has a depth of possibility in it that we're trying to cultivate a connection with it here. In Zen retreats, they have a verse that they say every evening. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of extreme importance. Time passes swiftly by, and opportunity is lost. Take heed. Do not squander your lives. My feeling is that this moment-to-moment awareness makes our lives longer. Like, if we die tomorrow, at least we lived today. There were more moments of wakefulness for me today than there would have been in my ordinary, kind of rather rushed and busy life. So what do we really care about? That's why we're here. That's sort of the life side of the important matter. Then there's the death side of the great matter, in that life is happening at all times. Whether we're on board with it or not, it does seem to go on as long as it goes on, and it stops when it's going to stop. And apparently life doesn't necessarily care whether we're on board or not. Yet as human beings, you know, there's a way that we care and that it really matters to us profoundly what happens to us and how we do relate to what's going on. You know, each of us is here maybe in some sense because we yearn to understand or to be at home in life, and this sense of division that we have from life pains us, and we're searching for a way to be happy, to be free, to be contented, to be at one with ourselves, with other people. And there's some way in which every human being wants this. It's as much a part of us as walking on our hind legs. So you might call this the bodhicitta, the enlightenment thought that we all carry and that we all express in completely different ways. Like, here we are together, we all have very unique mental styles, practice styles, And yet there's enough commonality to bring us here together in this room around this one force in life, which is a beneficial and beautiful force. And maybe we want it for ourselves most intimately. We care about ourselves the most, and we're self-centered to some extent. I was very relieved once in a practice with a Burmese teacher where he said, you know, about enlightenment, about liberation, you have license to be selfish. Like, you have to resolve this for yourself and in yourself before you can be helpful to others. And I think that piece of it is, like, making it okay. Like, this is an inner inquiry that we have. And it doesn't mean that we're leaving other people out of the equation. Of course, we care about other people. We care deeply about other people. And we often care about the impact that we have on them when we are out of balance. And that's another reason why we're here. To bring our practice to a place where we have something more clarity to offer to the world, a basis for action, is another very important part of us. We're not alone, and we know it. So in any case, this practice is one of the possible methods to harmonize or to fulfill this profound yearning that we have. So we're here also because we're kind of ready to do something about the problem that we have. And that is also, that's another step yet. I have a very close relationship with my stepdaughter, who's now a senior in college, and she has to write a senior project. And she said, you know, I really care a lot about poor people, and I want to write about the conditions in the third world, but I'm afraid if I write about, you know, she's a very style maven. She said, well, I'm kind of interested in where my clothes come from. I thought I might go around and ask people if they know who made their clothes or where their clothes come from. And she said, but I'm afraid to do that because, you know, I don't think I would enjoy wearing my clothes so much if I knew where they came from, you know. And I said, well, I'm not going to tell you that you have to make the connection between those two things, you know, because I'm your stepmother also, and anything I tell you, you're going to hate. So I just have to say, like, it's really interesting the way you're holding that question, and I know that you're going to find your way in life to honor both sides of what, you know, how to take care of myself is basically what she's asking, and how to take care of other people at the same time as taking, and what does it mean to become a more sensitive person in this world? I mean, actually, I think, you know, her question is not only just about third world garment. It's something very psychological with her. So there's also things I don't want to just prescribe, because also with young people, you just tell them that they'll work it out themselves and support them as they ask. You know, she wasn't asking me the question to be told what to think. She was letting me in on her process. So, but in any case, there does come a time when, about the suffering in ourselves especially, we become ready to do something. Sometimes we just get to our wits' end and we go to a retreat. And that's a valid thing to do. I mean, people do that for years and then start going to retreat for different reasons after that. I mean, I used to feel like I was, every time I came to IMS, I was crawling up the steps to be put back together, you know, by the staff and the food and the 10 days of being kind of away from sort of, quote-unquote, myself, you know. And that's how it is. So we hope that by the activity that we do here, which is a very intense activity, it's not that we're doing nothing. I mean, we're doing a very intense form of nothing. But that that life will respond to this effort that we're putting in. Like, that's the trust that we have, and that's what the people farther down the path can say to the people beginning on the path, that it does have an effect and it works. And it may not be linear, but it's guaranteed. So this started with the Buddha, who had a sense of this existential problem. You know, he was troubled by seeing old age, sickness, and death, and by realizing that he too was vulnerable to these things. He saw suffering around himself. He had been sort of coddled in his life, and his family had a very strong idea of who he should be and what he should do, but he was really perturbed by the existential questions more than by the idea of how to manage a kingdom, which is what he was supposed to do. Upon recognizing his own vulnerability and that of other people, he left his life. And I remember being very angry and upset that he would have left his wife and child right after she had a baby, that I thought that was the most sexist setup for religion you could imagine. And how could I practice based on this sort of mythology? I mean, I couldn't quite tell if it was like historical or mythological, but I've come around to thinking that psychologically it sounds like something very real. If you think about, you know, that he wasn't so old, he was a young guy, And his entire life, his father had tried to control his environment completely so that he would not get these kinds of ideas. It was kind of like, well, there's an elephant in the room. There was a prophecy made when he was born that he might become a great sage or the greatest king of the area. And it's a little bit like a fairy tale. The father was saying, like, I really don't want him to become a sage, so I'm going to, like, make his life as beautiful as possible, like, you know, making sure that he didn't observe any suffering, which is also kind of what we try to do, is, like, to not, you know, control our environment as much as we can. But then at some point it came through, and to this young, susceptible man who had these strong tendencies toward wanting to be liberated, I can just see him saying, like, man, I can't deal with any of this life that is supposed to be the life that I'm supposed to have. I've got to find my own way and whatever it takes. So I feel a lot more sympathy and understanding toward him, leaving his princess wife and his young child and going off to find out what was the way to be free. And in a sense, it's much said, we all need to leave home, or to be willing to leave home psychologically, sometimes physically. We came here. Sometimes people don't want us to come here. They get lonely or needy or something judgmental. My father used to say to me, well, how was it staring at the four walls? I was like, well, I had a good time, Dad. he's gotten better. You know, he actually understands a lot more. The cultural level has kind of increased around this. Like, when you used to sit on a plane, conversation stoppers of all time. Where have you been? Oh, I've been on a meditation retreat. But there's something we do need to look at ourselves in a different way and be willing to challenge our assumptions and, you know, go against our preferences and kind of give something a try that we don't know whether or not it will totally work. Face difficulties in ourselves, admit things we are not proud of, trust the instructions, take a leap. We can say it works, but until it works for you, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. So what is it that we have to actually do in this practice? We have to enact that fourth noble truth that Eric talked about last night. It was the first sermon that the Buddha gave. His first teaching was about the four noble truths. So it's a very important one. It's very simple and easy to remember, so I'm going to somewhat use it again as the substance of this talk. But the translation I love, I just encountered in the life of the Buddha. In his first sermon, he didn't necessarily talk about the Noble Eightfold Path, although that's often what's talked about as the fourth noble truth, but it's maintaining and being the way that leads to the cessation of suffering. So I like to call it being willing to be present and being present. Which sums up a lot. And you can unpack that endlessly through yards and yards of Buddhist books. But this present moment awareness, it is the path, it's the heart of the path. And then, it's expressed in so many different ways, giving us the capacity to choose our action and our relationship. But we aren't able to choose unless we're aware, because we really don't know what's happening. So then, we tend to be sort of taken over by mental sensations and events and the rapidity of everything, and end up kind of behaving in the same old ways. I'm not saying that, there's never any choices. It's not like we don't decide, like, to get up in the morning or to, what career to do, but to have a choice at this profound, intimate level of relationship with reality, that's requires a little bit more awareness than the ordinary type. Now, maintaining and being the way that leads to the cessation of suffering, I have learned through my long years of practice, which are now since 1977, so that's 26 years of practice, that an inept and imperfect attempt to maintain in being the way that leads to suffering is also effective. So the way that you do it is good enough. That's a very important thing, because whatever level of awareness you can muster is enough. And I'm now doing a wrathful Tibetan practice where you're supposed to slightly let your awareness be a little messed up. You know, it's just like, let it be just the way it is. Let it come out sweaty. Let it come out a mess. Just be aware of the catastrophe in whatever sort of minor way you're able to do it. Just do it in that way. If you're caught up in the story part of the day, if you notice one breath, that is enough to also be the way towards the cessation of suffering. Like, you really have to let your practice be your practice as it is in you, and to trust that, and to let it be real to you and be valuable to you, without comparing it to the lofty sounding words or the blueprints that are the tradition. Like, the blueprints are very important, the maps of where we're going and how to do it, and yet the real way is in oneself, and it never feels the way it is when it's described. Like, it's sort of the way that parents must fail their children or their children can't grow up, and the children never develop any individuality. Also, the description at some point fails, and it's for you to realize. And it's never cut and dried or neat and clear. I mean, there are times when it does feel neat and clear, but really, a lot of the time, it feels very indefinite. Letting your awareness be as it is, and letting everything be as it is. But get in the habit of turning the light on inside, of turning toward experience in awareness, or of recognizing the fact that you're aware at any given moment, and that this moment is as important in whatever modality your awareness is showing up. Like, your awareness of me speaking now may not feel like the same intense awareness of the breath, but if you can learn to value and trust and kind of keep that thread moment after moment after moment, the practice can really flower in a very profound way. Not turning away, not disconnecting. Be willing to be there. And I sometimes think in the relaxation of, in the sense of, like, be aware, like, think of being aware, and then you just sort of settle down a little bit, and there's a type of sort of gap that opens up through which you can sort of, you sort of fly in to your situation, like, easily and naturally, just by letting it be. And it's not necessarily like you always know what object you're encountering at that time. Like, sometimes there's a sense of sort of the body, which is kind of a mass of sensations or softness, and some seeing and hearing. But, you know, it's often good to not have to really clamp down around an object, especially in these kind of indeterminate situations, like listening to a talk. But so when I talked before about, like, leaving home and turning the light on and enacting the practice, it's like very important with effort is to figure out where to make your effort and how to keep it in balance. There are times in practice when really pushing hard feels like the best thing, like sleeping less and, like, really homing in on objects, you know, being very precise about your movements, moving very slowly, all of those things, and challenging oneself to sort of go beyond the limitations for what we thought our energy was. There are other times when it's important to indulge in big distractions. If your mind is just going crazy and you're in the world, you're in the room with the 100-ton gorilla, sometimes going to a movie is good. Like, just finding a way to subtract yourself from the situation. It's like when you're in kind of a bad situation where people are fighting and you know, like, that you're not going to be able to have fun at this party, then you go home. Well, the same thing with your mind. Like, there are times when you need to sort of look at something different, you know, look at the sky, look at the, you know, don't be in there with that. So distraction is sometimes a method. My husband is very interested in World War II and in people who escaped from prisoner of war camps. And there's a manual for escapers that one of them wrote. He was an inveterate person who, you know, this is also a way of wanting to be free, to not be a captive. So he said, don't overlook any possibilities, including drugging the guards. So, don't overlook any possibilities for how to practice. And when this practice really becomes your own in this way, that you can learn how to turn the light on anywhere you are, then it's an inalienable possession. It's something that no one can take from you. And that's sort of the dignity or the pride of being a yogi or being a true practitioner. And for the true practitioner, the practice never really stops. It can't be taken away, and it doesn't stop. And even those of us who have taken big detours in practice, or times when we weren't officially practicing a formal practice, often those times are times when we're looking for a truth that's not contained in what we've heard from the front of the room, or when we need to heal some form of betrayal, or when it feels too strict, or anything. You know, can your life really be your practice? And when the practice settles into your being in this way, at that time, it is when it becomes helpful for the moment of your dying. Because this capacity to take each moment as it comes and be with each thing as it is, the inner things that come up as well as the outer things. So it's not just being with unpleasant people, it's with being able to be irritated with the unpleasant person and being able to be with all of the inner and outer manifestations of reality that we deal with. When we can learn to be with how we feel, how we react, and also to drop into sometimes the part of nature that doesn't know that the talk is going to happen in 2 minutes, that doesn't know that I've been told I'm dying. When you can sort of work with this, then at the times when your mind and body are starting to fall apart, then it'll be a lot easier to have something to rely on at that time when everything is being taken away. And this is something that is going to happen to everyone in this room, believe it or not. We will all die at some point. And we all kind of will have to be able to do it in whatever messy way. You know, so being able to have a messy practice is also good because your mind will probably not be very able to be focused. I mean, you may not be in a place where you're comfortable. Your mind, body may be in a lot of pain. So when you get discombobulated here, it's full of value for your future. It's also something that you have to face alone, you know, and you have to find in yourself the capacity to face that alone, and also to recognize that other people, as they're undergoing this, also find in themselves, in whatever way they're going to do it. When my mother was dying, she really drove me crazy. Like, she didn't want to be dying, and so she wasn't, sort of, and so she just behaved. One of her worst tricks was she had just moved to this new neighborhood, and she was kind of getting worse and worse, and she didn't tell anyone she was sick because she was afraid that they would not want to be her friends or something like that. And therefore, I felt she was cutting herself off from all kinds of support of people who might have wanted to know, and that it was something mean in her that she didn't want people to know. But that was her, and that was how she did it. So she had this Easter party where she invited all her new neighbors right after she'd had some, like, horrible set of chemo treatments, and she didn't come to her own party until the very end, and then she kind of made it down the stairs, and she looked terrible, and that was her announcement, like, you know, and people were like, oh my God, you know, and it was like, that was how she wanted to do it. And then at the very, very end, she died with such amazing grace and beauty and acceptance, and, you know, after all of, you know, whatever it was that it took for her to get to that place, and she ordered a bunch of, you know, stuff from catalogs and stuff, so that it kept coming after she was dead, like it was as if she was sending us presents from the other world. You know, and I mean, that was my mom. Like, she just, you know, and it was like letting her do it in her way was kind of the teaching for me at that point, like to not have her live up to my standards. But say for ourselves, you know, to figure out in what way can the practice protect us. Like, it's not easy to know how we will respond if, when, you know, the death process begins. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's probably one of the more evolved beings, practices 4 hours a day, and he says he's preparing for dying himself. And if he needs to do that, maybe we do too. You know, for those of you who think of Tibetan tradition, if he's going to choose his next rebirth, he has a little taller order than most of us. All we have to do is sort of go out with some grace, I guess, and awareness. But he has to figure out what womb he's going to. So that's more than we're asking of ourselves. But then, you know, there are also deaths in life, the little deaths and losses, when we lose someone or we lose part of ourselves that we cherished, or we lose an ability, or we lose a job, or how do we be friendly with those experiences and how do we make it through? There is sort of lesser and greater freaking out when those things happen. And there's sort of watching your mind go out of control and allowing it to sort of be an ape, and then there's gently reeling it in, and then there's looking at other aspects of life, and then there's the learning that we get from those situations. The capacity to come to the present moment in all of those moments is very, very important. We need to be able to give space to our feelings as they come up. This is like a super important thing in life in general, just in ordinary life, to have permission to be a human being and to have a variety of emotional experiences in 5 minutes or in 24 hours, to have like good things, bad things. If you look at a baby, how unshielded they are, and then anyone who spends time with babies knows that adults are just the same, only with more armor, right? The inner three-year-old. And how little space they have also to modulate what goes on. You know, like when something just becomes a disaster because, you know, they really don't want to wear this pair of shoes today, and it's like, you know, and then suddenly something, it's kind of like some little joggle goes off in their head, and suddenly everything's fine and it's over and they're happy, and then they go back to, you know, we're a lot like that. And can we allow ourselves to be like that since we are like that? It's not, you know, it helps if we have a little space where it's okay. And in allowing ourselves to have these feelings, we begin to see what their nature really is. Like if you repress them, you can't see them, kind of by definition, if you hide from them. And you see that actually this emotional flow is something that is sort of ongoing. And if you stop it at any given point and say, you know, this is me, you don't have the whole picture. The mind is constantly, you know, grasping on and trying to stop the flow of things and corral, you know, one part of experience, whether you like it or not. It's like there are times when you hate what's going on and then you think, this is me. And then there's time when you love what's going on and you think, oh, this is me, you know. And both of those. And then there's the part in between when you're kind of bored and this can be me too, if you like. So death again. Death has been browsing in the forest just outside this retreat, as we have heard from several people here dealing with the deaths of people very close to them, or the imminent deaths, or the recent deaths. It has touched us all, and it will continue to do so up until it gets us. So this reflection on death is considered a very important part of the practice, and what it does is it enhances the appreciation of each moment. That's sort of where it goes, to make you more alive now. So this life, our investigation, and our heartfelt interest in it will end at some point. So between now and then, leave no stone unturned. Try to see for yourself what you need to see, what you want to see. I've done a little bit of teaching in Spanish, and the word mindfulness has no translation in Spanish. And so one of the possible translations we came up with was meditation of profound consciousness, conciencia profunda, deep seeing and responsibility is kind of implied by those words. Or ser consciente is another one, to be conscious. But meditation of deep awareness, it's like when you look at the breath and the breathing and it loses its label, then what is life? You know, then what is occurring? We are so lucky to know about this contact of awareness with life. I mean, it really is, you know, life and death are very important. This awareness of life, this capacity to really turn toward awareness, to train ourselves to come awake in any moment is so, it is the jewel. It's the most important thing. And to burnish it and value it and rejoice in it and to know what it really is and to sense its implications is, I guess that's probably the main point of this talk. There's nothing that can come between you and your awareness, I guess, except for, you know, Mara or delusion. But even delusion is regarded as incidental and superficial in comparison with awareness. It's something that's sort of on top of it, covers it over, but can't take it away. So how to find this for ourselves so that no outer authority can shake us from ourselves, from our connection with this, from this awareness that comes from inside, that we don't have to fabricate, that came as part of our life kit. The Buddha's instructions. There's always that parable about the finger pointing at the moon. But if a lot of times you wouldn't see the moon if someone didn't tell you to look up. So, you know, you do follow the finger and then you see the moon. So I like that. The finger isn't so bad. If you only look at the finger for a long time, eventually you'll go up the end of it. So here the finger is pointing to breath by breath, you know, breath by breath. And reflecting on the meaning of breath is something, how important the breath is. But also going deeper with the breath, how it loses the label, it loses our conventional assumption. It becomes an occurrence in awareness. It becomes many different things. The metaphor is often used by Buddhist teachers that it's like looking in a microscope and seeing that a drop of water contains a lot of life. There's touching, there's movement, there's beginning, there's ending. There's stiffness. Maybe there's boredom. Maybe there's something kind of intangible. What is really the breath? What is anything that impacts upon the mind? What is awareness? This thing that's intangible and impalpable and yet which we can direct. Like you can say, you know, I want to be aware of my right foot right now. And you will be. It's strange. And what is it that arrives in your right foot to feel all the tingling there? It's the fastest moving thing in the universe. The mind also can go to the moon and back in a flash. It has no fixed location. It has no body, and yet it's the most powerful thing in the world. Our body seems to have a location or be a location, and yet the body moves around. Actually, the body is never completely still. And if you look inside the body is always changing. So then what is the body? Is the body something permanent? Is the body where the mind is, or is the mind where the body is? Is the mind inside the body, or is the body inside the mind? We tend to think our mind, I mean, I think most people live a little bit kind of like behind here. But then if your heart, or is your mind able to be in your toe? Your mind is able to be in your toe, so then where is your mind? And is this whole room in our mind, perhaps? Like if you can see all the way to the corner, then is your mind inside your body, or is your mind in the corner? When you are off wandering in your meditation practice and you realize you weren't with yourself, you were with someone else, you were in some sort of bubble, you know, talking to your mother or your partner. You know, was that your mother? Was that your partner? Or where was your mind then? So also then, can we really believe in this identification that we have with ourselves in quite the same way? I mean, we sort of just carry around this very unexamined philosophical view of ourselves that's pretty flawed. So what does it mean when we say, I am hungry? I am hungry. Those sensations in the body, sort of a burning feeling in the stomach, or an emotional hunger. What is exactly I am hungry? It starts to, the labels start to loosen quite a bit. This picture is me when I was a child. How about that? Are we still that child? Or our name? You know, like, does anyone have issues with their name? Would anyone wish they had a different name? So are we our names? But we need a name so that if, you know, people want to refer to us. But the name of a person has a flavor. I know when I'm writing, I always think, well, this person shouldn't be called so-and-so. They should be called something else. And, you know, they shouldn't just be called Bob. They should be called Alex. So we impute so much to people on the basis of their names or their bodies, how they appear, and to ourselves, our bodies, how we appear. Our mind can actually hate our body, or our mind can hate the body of other people. You know, is a person complete if they don't have a complete body, or if their body is old, or if their body is young, or if their body is brown? it's sort of funny, except it's not funny a lot of the times when it manifests. So if you look at how we construct our reality, big cracks start to appear in it almost immediately, liberating cracks. If you say that this is the nature of the world, partly to be a construction, but to be an incomplete construction, looking into our experience through the day and saying, like, that there's a continuity of myself who has arrived here in this place, well, I don't know if there is really a basis for believing that. It's more as if, you know, the flip cards that you have of the little running dog, like when you flip the corner of the page and it appears to run. There were so many states that we went into, and they appear to be a continuity. But in fact, we've been born and died again and again many times through the day. We've been born as the bored person, or as the exalted person, or the lunch eater. And if we can be free to allow ourselves to be born and die in all these different positions, then we are free. There's some liberation every time any object ceases. That's even recognized in the conventional way of looking at reality. You can say, well, you know, this too shall pass, or at least that's over. You know, there's like calm after these storms. This retreat also will end. It will fold up like a deck of cards and disappear. All this whole situation, the chairs will be put back, the zabutons will disappear, everyone will go home, and it will be as if in some way it never had existed. And when we're in the retreat, there are people who are in this gathering now who are not, quote unquote, in the retreat, and even the people who are in the retreat, what is the retreat? And, you know, it's, we are with ourselves and this process in a particular, quote, situation, but if you really look at it, there's no retreat, or you could say there's no retreat. So I'm just sort of playing some slightly verbal games with hints at some larger vision, that when you come very close to experience, you have something to compare conceptual reality to. I used to think in the last Burmese retreat I did, where you slow down a lot, where you eat less and sleep less and creeping around and paying intense attention to every moment of your experience, I thought, like, I must be doing really weird things to my brain chemistry. That this whole experience is almost designed to kind of force you through some type of transformed relationship with what's going on. And we are definitely putting energy into different parts of our brain with our attention. We're definitely sort of, you know, very sort of maybe laboriously in some cases creating a type of altered state different from normal state. It's beginning to be studied now scientifically. Like, from the practitioner's perspective, it may not be that relevant that you're sending blood to the forward part of your brain, but it is actually kind of interesting in terms of developing faith or understanding that we actually really are doing something, that we're really affecting our process, and it can be measured physically. This trying to be present moment to moment. Most of the fancy words in Buddhism refer to this, your natural state, the supreme state of awareness, the ultimate truth, the non-conceptual reality that you touch upon without the need for thinking. Even the nature of thinking partakes of the ultimate truth when you're not inside your thoughts or like rolling along, you know, being controlled by the story, but seeing the story as a story. That's seeing things from the point of view of ultimate truth. And the ultimate truth is expressing itself all the time through you and as you. So that's kind of a wild one, but if we stop, look, and listen, we can begin to taste the flavor or be able to see it as such. It's required to scrape off sort of various layers of the conventional rust by which we just sort of run through life in a habitual way. So this is what we're doing here, is kind of scraping. Scraping down to the moment, scraping down to experience as it is. And it's not that we need to find some special experience, since ultimate reality is expressing itself all the time, no matter whether we're aware of it or not, or no matter whether we like it or not. So as we learn to look more deeply, you see and you recognize and you appreciate that ultimate reality is arising now, in each thing or as each thing, exactly as it is, and just as it is. Not as you think it should be, not as you wish it should be, not as you prefer it to be. And there's that sort of point of view of the insight into moment-to-moment reality, where it sort of reminds me of those chocolate oranges that if you bang it at the right place, it just sort of opens up and you see sort of what's inside it. And that's a little bit what I'm trying to indicate. Of course, there are times when we feel like we're banging and banging and banging and we don't see anything, or we're sort of banging our head against the practice or reality and we just have a sense of stuckness. And what tends to be the issue there is that we're not able to be aware of the sense of being stuck and being frustrated. We want to get out of being frustrated. So we bang and bang and bang and we don't see anything, because the main event that's going on is that we're feeling frustrated. If you look at the, if you're able, you know, the awareness has to be a little sort of, you know, flexible at that point. But if you're able to look at the sense of frustration, then you see that it's something that's happening in your mind. And it just has the reality of a mental state in the moment, that's all. And that is the beginning of being able to allow it to drop away and become impermanent, rather than be getting into a struggle with it and sort of keeping it around by fighting with it more, solidifying it. So what we're looking for here to be aware of or at is trying to feel that point of contact of awareness and ourselves, this point of reality, training the awareness to have a good connection and contact with reality or the object as it is. Try to leave every hair in place of your object when you encounter it. Try to leave it exactly as it's going to be, not disturbing the object, but sort of inquiring of it, what is your nature? Who are you? Oh, strange object presented to my awareness. And usually it's not going to be exactly what you want it to be. I would say like 99% of the objects are not necessarily the one you expected or wanted or were ready for. So that's where coming back again and again and trying to encounter the object as purely as possible is helpful. So the other thing to do is to try to get them right at the point when they arise, like when they've just started and they're fresh. This moment of contact is important. That's why in Zen they have the clacker, you know, when they end the sitting with this bang, you know, like right now, you know, be aware right now, like gravel against a window, wake up like that. That can be a little less relaxed. I mean, they also tend to try to power through things a lot in certain schools of Zen works, but that's not necessarily our way. Like, we also stay with the fading sound of this bell and see what happens. Like, when has it entirely disappeared? When are things coming into being? When are things going out of being? This morning, for example, is gone. Those kinds of things are occasionally useful to recognize, the arising and passing away of objects. Ruth Denison would speak about leaving a room when she leaves, leaving the room and leaving it behind her, noticing the cessation of having been in that room. That can ease the burden of the conceptual continuity that we carry around with this kind of continuous identity. Loosening is often enough, sort of letting in a breath of air into our process. But in order to be with things precisely as they arise and pass away and begin to see the individual images in that deck of cards, it's very helpful to be continuous in practice through the day and to stick kind of with your body sensation. So like the dance of opening the door and brushing your teeth and getting up and stuff like that, and the movement of your individual limbs, to take a real appreciative interest in the fact that this is happening, like grounding in the body and seeing a movement arise and pass away. Like, okay, so my hand is here. Now it's over here, it's not here anymore. You know, really getting an appreciation of that type of thing will help you begin to see how everything is arising and disbanding, arising and disbanding, arising and disbanding, and even the ephemerality of things in the moment that they are present. This is something that's important to see directly, not as a concept. Seeing the breath coming and going. So if you have the attention to the breath as it arises through its manifestation and until the end of the in-breath, and then if there's a pause to the out-breath, and trying to develop as much continuity and registering the beginning, the middle, and end of things. Beginning and middle and end of your mood, your bad mood that you may be in. Like, if you're in the middle of a bad mood, just say you're in the middle. And then if it's over, you know, even if you only notice it hours later, you can say, well, that was the bad mood I was in at 2 o'clock, and now I'm not quite such in it. So as you notice your physical movements and sensations, you also begin to be able to be a little bit more aware of mental states and feelings as they come and go inside you, that thoughts are not constant, that they're fleeting. Watching a thought pass away is one of the most blissful experiences of a meditator. It's great when you sort of see it for what it is and then you're no longer bound within it. Thoughts are kind of nothing special. They come in the mind and they go away, and they try to get us involved with them, and usually we do go in and start to dance around as the puppet of our thinking. One of the Tibetan nuns that I spent the summer with, she was talking about this guy who's very, very, very sweet and also very agitated all the time. And she just said, you know, his mind says go do this and he has to do it. He has like no control over his mind. His mind just is bothering him all the time. He tells him go here, he goes. And then she made this little movement like this. She said, he has no control over, you know, he has no choice when his mind tells him to do stuff. So to be, in order to be less subjected to your mind, gaining a little bit of a sense of its fleeting nature can be very important. Let's see, where are we in the time? All right, we're almost an hour. So looking into thinking and feeling and thoughts to be real, that wants us to be real, that wants perceptions, emotions, and feelings to be real. And this is one of the places where I locate the second noble truth, the craving. Craving for some firm and solid existence that isn't so impermanent. And we get very caught with this. The mind can become like this sort of Hoover parasite, like trying to latch onto something to kind of give it a sense of substance. But the way of sort of unhooking from that is seeing, you know, gently, gently encouraging yourself to let go into giving permission for things to be as they are, which is that they're fluid, they're impermanent, and they're in some sense kind of hollow or ephemeral. That was it. And they are that way. It's not like the practice kind of makes them be that way. And finding the place where you can be in harmony with things as they are, as they really are, then allowing them to reveal, you know, confess their inner nature to you. So we are doing that practice here. You know, it's very much a matter of implementation, of making it a part of your own heart mind. And it starts with the very outer practice of morality, is saying, like, I have a choice about how I'm going to behave in any given moment. I may feel one way. I may feel like chopping your head off or biting your head off verbally, but I'm not going to. That is the beginning of not allowing your mind to control you, because a lot of times we wish to do many things that are harmful and that we don't want to perpetuate. And to both give yourself permission to have the feelings of a human being and the behavior of a sort of noble human being is part of this practice. I'm going on a little bit long, I think. So, the second choice that we make is about where we do place our attention, and to come into the present regardless of what object is there is the discipline of concentration or samadhi, mind training. And when we are looking like this in the moment and choosing to bring our attention again and again into the present moment, to open the depth of seeing, like to see what are we looking at, like to both look and also to see, to allow the profundity of vision to arise, see how the mind relates to whatever it's relating to. So if you're entangled, see yourself as entangled. Don't try to become disentangled in order to see. Just let yourself see what kind of entanglement you are enacting in this moment. And there's a kind of an axiom that when you see it, it begins to be released. It's not the way that it was before you saw. So if you just catch yourself in the middle of thinking, then you see yourself thinking, that is a treasure of such value. You shouldn't so immediately go back to the breath. You should say, like, what is this that I'm thinking, and then I'm away from the breath, and then assess that, and then go back. See how you get engaged and obsessed. See how unpleasant things lead the mind to get agitated, and see how pleasure leads us to be infatuated. Some time ago, I was having an interview with my Tibetan teacher and telling him various things that were going on in my practice, and I was telling him something. He said, "Oh, wow, this would be a really great time for you to do a year-long retreat. Like, you could really deepen on that." And I said, "Oh, boy, well, you know, it's not the time in my life when I can do a year-long retreat. I'm committed to being married. I'm, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I don't see it, like, on the near horizon." I said, "The best thing that I can do is to be aware of everything in my life as it goes." And he said, "Oh, well, that's the highest practice." And it was, like, really not disappointing to him that I said it. It was like, okay, well, if you approach it like that, then that's the highest practice, more than being in a retreat. And I would like to offer that to all of us, because that is the situation that most of us are in. If we can do a year retreat, that's great. And if we can't, then we are, you know, constrained and given the practice of living life as it arises, in whatever mode it arises, in whatever way we can be aware, as best we can, is the highest practice for us. And it is, you know, the practice of life as integrated with Dharma, as much as we can see it. So in conclusion, there's a quotation that I saw just before I came to this retreat. On the back wall of a pizzeria in Cambridge, someone had written, for some reason, "The path does not lead to happiness. The path is happiness." Mm-hmm. So I hope that we can appreciate that through all the permutations of, you know, whatever is coming next that we don't know. Sit quietly for a minute.